It would be a safe bet that someone somewhere in the world right now is being killed in the name of religion. Not long ago, we were watching Muslim killing Muslim. If we switched to Kashmir, it would be Muslim and Hindu. If we dropped down to India, it would be Hindus killing Christians in Orissa. Drop down to Sri Lanka and it would be Hindus and Buddhists. Not long ago in Northern Ireland, it would be Catholics and Protestants. And so it goes. If you think about it, when we look back at the end of the last century, which was the most murderous century in all human history, 100 million were killed by war, in war. Another 100 million human beings were killed under political repression. And tragically, yet another 100 million human beings killed in sectarian and ethnic violence. And some of the lessons as we look back on that were very obvious. One is, one of the great problems of our world today is how we live with deep differences. And there's nothing deeper than religious differences. We know we can travel anywhere in the world in a few hours. We know through our media, we see everything as it happens. And in a world of migrations and people on the moves, it's now said that everyone is now everywhere. So the challenge of living with our deep differences is genuinely a world problem. Doesn't sound urgent like, say, nuclear proliferation or AIDS or whatever, but it's actually deeper because it underlies so many of the other issues. And of course, in this country, it breaks out in terms of culture warring all the time. But a second thing we can see as you look back at the end of the last century is that we're beginning to see the emergence of what's now called a global public square. Public square has always been precious to us as Westerners. Going back to the Greeks, if you've been to Athens and you've seen the agora, where they debated and decided the issues of their common public life, it was a literal place. And then it became a metaphor. The public square not only included, say, the House of Parliament or the Congress, but the op-ed pages of our papers where we as Westerners debate our public life. But now, of course, the age of the internet. And if you think of the Danish cartoons or the Pope's speech at Regensburg, the lesson is that even when we're not speaking to the world, consciously, deliberately, we can be heard by the world. And there can be reactions anywhere in the world to what's said anywhere else in the world. And we're seeing the emergence of a global public square, which raises the question of how do we speak about people with great differences in ways that don't inflame the world? But another thing was increasingly clear at the end of the century. This country, the United States, which has the most nearly perfect way of doing this so far in human history, is not doing very well today. And we've had 30 years of culture warring. And most sad of all, the Church of Christ in this country has been identified with the unwisdom and the extremism. One seeking friend said to me recently, "How can I take the Christian faith seriously when I look at the leaders of the Christian right and so often I see them with their foot in their mouth and their pants down?" Today, in many circles, evangelicals are not known to be people of the good news, followers of Jesus bringing his ways. They're known for much of the ugliness. And to be really blunt, in the previous election, much of the ugliest rhetoric was from the left against a Republican president. In this election, much of the ugliest rhetoric was from the right. And I got emails from Texas very often, which were ashamed to the name of Christ, with a gutter prejudice and hatred that was passed around with a candidate from the other side. We have a problem. Let me, in the few minutes I have, just lay out some of the contours of this to you. First, why is it that the American experiment became the world's most nearly perfect settlement, solution? There are three reasons. First, they put in place what the framers called the first liberty. freedom of conscience, religious liberty. Now, in much of the world and much of America today, that wouldn't be the first liberty. The first liberty would be freedom of speech, freedom of the press, or whatever. But for the framers, if you think of it, freedom of conscience was logically first. Why? Freedom of assembly. You only want to get together with people to whom you want to say something that matters to you. In other words, freedom of assembly assumes freedom of speech. But equally, freedom of speech, it assumes you want to say something that truly matters to you. You don't want to just get together and talk about the weather or whatever. You want to talk about something you believe passionately is true and right and just and good or whatever. In other words, freedom of assembly assumes freedom of speech, and freedom of speech assumes freedom of conscience. That which we are bound to believe based on the dictates of our conscience. And freedom of conscience isn't freedom of choice. Choose whatever you like. No. Freedom of conscience, you are bound. And that's why it's respected. People are not just free to decide. No, they are bound by their conscience, and so one respects their conscience, and so on. The framers were right. That is the first liberty. But there was a second reason. Religious liberty is one of the great secrets of American entrepreneurialism. Again, that's not a fashionable idea today. People would say, why Americans great entrepreneurs? Capitalism, market capitalism. Not actually. That came later. But if you think the First Amendment long preceded capitalism, but it rules out any establishment, and in economic terms, that's a monopoly. It demonopolizes and then sets everyone free based on their freedom of conscience to believe and practice their faith as they wish. And you can see in the early 19th century as this happened, the established churches did badly. And the ones who did well were the evangelicals because they were truly entrepreneurial. And that is behind the educational movement, many of America's best colleges. That's behind the explosion of charity. That's behind the movements towards reform, above all in abolition. Why? They were entrepreneurial. Those who had the faiths that mattered to them and were generous and sacrificial and outgoing, they did it. And there was an explosion of entrepreneurialism that now we call fancy names like social capital and civil society and so on. But the First Amendment just gave freedom for it, and of course, your church is doing it wonderfully. But the third great thing that was behind the American way of doing it was it created social harmony. Now, you Americans know this so well, you almost yawn. But as a European, my family's Irish, and we're actually from the South, not the North, where they had the troubles. But I know well when prejudice and hatred burst out into violence. I've seen it in Asia, where I was born and lived 10 years, and I know it in my home country, Ireland. What did America do different? You know it so well, you probably hardly realize the significance. It brought together two things which in most of the world rarely come together. The freedom of strong religious convictions and the freedom of strong political civility. Now, those are just words. What do I mean? Many countries in the world have political civility. Take, say, Western Europe. After World War II, before the huge influx of Commonwealth immigrants and Muslim immigrants into Europe, Western Europe was very, very civil about religion, with the one exception, Ulster, Northern Ireland. But if you know where Europe, you'd say, big deal. They're very civil about religion because there's almost no religion. Nothing to fight about. Take the Scandinavians. Where have they settled in this country? The upper Midwest, Minnesota, and so on. Church going there is still today in the 70s. Way above the American average of the 40s. What is it in Sweden, where they came from? 3%. 3% go to church, you're not going to be fighting about it. Now, in other parts of the world, of course, say the Middle East, they had passionate religious convictions and no civility. But the amazing thing in this country, although you've had violations such as the nativism in the 1830s and 50s, you've had your egregious violations, but by and large, strong religious convictions and strong political civility have gone hand in hand until the recent culture warring. What's gone wrong? What are the changes since the First Amendment and the greatness of the American settlement? Well, let me mention a couple of factors. First, this country has seen an explosion of pluralism. That's obvious. The early colonies were very, very pluralistic. In fact, the middle colonies, Pennsylvania, was probably the most diverse place on the earth religiously. Scores and scores and scores and scores of different sects, but they were all Protestant. And then came the Catholics. And then came the Jews. And then in the 19th century came the so-called made-in-America religions like Mormonism and so on. But if you stop the clock about 1959, America was incredibly diverse religiously, but almost all loosely biblical with a small b. In other words, not Orthodox Christian, but people who trace their ideas back to the Bible. The Mormons don't trace their ideas back to the Quran, or the Bhagavad Gita, or the Pali Canon, or the Buddhists. They trace it back to the Bible. We wouldn't say they're Christians. Many of them don't claim to be Christians. But it's the Bible they trace it back to, not somewhere else. Then in the 1960s, there was another explosion. You had a huge increase of people who were secular in one decade. Went from about 2% up to 9, 10, 11%. And they were mostly in the educated circles, which was very significant. And then there was an explosion of people with all the religions from all around the world. For example, many of the Buddhists who came in after the Vietnam War and so on. So now today you can find all the religions that are in the world somewhere, all here in America, probably in California. An explosion of pluralism. So, see, what does school prayer mean in that context? I met a Georgia Baptist who told me that he was a staunch believer in school prayer, but he never understood the Jewish parents in the school who were complaining their Jewish boy was the minority. Until, he said, he moved from Georgia to Utah. And suddenly his little Baptist son was the Jew in the classroom of Baptists in Georgia, because he was the minority among the Mormons. And he rethought the whole issue of school prayer. What is just and free for everybody? The minorities as well as the majority, and so on, exploding pluralism. The other huge difference since the framers is the rise of what's called separationism. The framers gave us the separation of church and state. And when some of the Christian right tell you the separation of church and state is not in the Constitution, they're dead wrong. The words are not. The idea is. Not only that, they all believed it. And Tocqueville, the 26-year-old Frenchman who comes around America in the 1830s, he says he can't find a single American who disagreed with the separation of church and state. Even his fellow Catholics. In other words, Frenchmen like him, who back in France would be in favor of a state church. But here they said the separation of church and state was the secret of American freedom, and they were in favor of it as Catholics. No one was against it. Everyone acknowledged it. What changed? In the 1940s, you had the rise of something different, not the separation of church and state, but the strict separation, or separationism. The framers separated church and state, but not faith and public life. But in the new view, which came up in the 1940s, the idea is that the public square is inviolably secular. No faith, no virtue, no morals. And religion, whatever it is inviolably private and should stay so. Now, obviously, that was put forward by atheists and by certain liberals and the Jewish position and so on. Tragically, it was argued in the Supreme Court by certain Baptists. And the Baptist who argued it most strongly and put it in now constitutional law was a Baptist, sadly, who was also a member of the Ku Klux Klan, who used that strict separation as a way of keeping Catholics out of public life as he saw it. Now, of course, it affects us all. So you see this new idea, religion inviolably private, keep it private. And the public square inviolably secular. That, of course, creates the conditions for the culture warring. So what are the options we have today? There are virtually three that we face, and we've got to think them through carefully and choose. And as Bob said, I'm strongly in favor of one, and I view the other two as extreme. One option is what's called the sacred public square. Those who believe in this country that one faith, while it can't be established, it should be privileged and preferred, as in school prayer. I would argue, and many others would too, that in our pluralistic, diverse conditions, that is unjust and unworkable and will always have endless arguments against it. I would not only argue that, I would say that the Christian right, by defending that position, has brought down on its head much of what it fears. If you look at Europe, there is a deep secularity in Europe. Almost everywhere. And it goes back to a deep reaction against state churches. Have you ever heard the cry of the French radicals? We want to strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. Rather brutal way of putting it, the revolutionaries. But you get the idea. There was a state church, and the church and state were in bed with each other. They were both oppressive, they were both corrupt, and the revolution threw off both of them. So in France, if you're in favor of faith, you must be very reactionary. If you're in favor of freedom, you've got to be secular and an atheist, and Europe is touched by that deeply today. America's never been troubled by that sort of thinking. Always a hospitality to people of all faiths until what? The rise of the culture warring and the rise of the religious right. And you can see now, if you read the New Atheists, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, in educated circles, there is now a hostility, a hatred of Christians associated with the extremism, as they perceive it, of the religious right. This is tragic. In many parts of this country today, Christians, and particularly evangelicals, we're not known for being people of the good news. Followers of Jesus who are in favor of peace and forgive wrongs done to us and love our enemies and so on, as William Wilberforce was, we're known for the ugliness of the tactics of the religious right. The sacred public square. The other extreme, and it is an extreme, and I'm against this one too, is what's called the naked public square. In other words, people like the ACLU and others, the strict separationists who want to remove all religion from public life. Now, that is, in fact, extremely illiberal. Atheism is one worldview among other worldviews. It's a faith, too. If they deny us the right to enter public life and to argue on the basis of the faith that makes us who we are, that's extremely illiberal. Not only that, it happens to undercut the very way the framers set up this country in terms of its legitimacy and freedom and so on. It's a disaster. What's the alternative? A civil public square. Now, the word civility is often misunderstood as niceness. You know, Emily Post, you know, tea party manners, dinner etiquette. That's not civility. Civility used to be a very robust word that was both a Republican virtue with a small r and a democratic necessity with a small d. What is a civil public square? It's a vision of public life in which everyone, of whatever faith or non-faith, is free to enter and engage public life on the basis of their faith. But, here's the big but, within an agreed framework of what is understood to be just and free for other people too. So, for example, a right for a Christian is, of course, a right for a Jew, and a right for an atheist, and a right for a Muslim, and a right for a Hindu, and a right for a Buddhist, and a right. And the test is always, is it respected for the tiniest minorities and the most unpopular groups? You might take, say, a group that today has greatly scorned Scientology. Intellectually, I have no time for Scientology, but a Scientologist, Tom Cruise, bless his heart, he has rights of freedom of conscience too. A right for one is a right for another, and of course a responsibility for both. And there are many implications for that, such as if we want to go into the public square and win the argument, say, over marriage or whatever, we have to go in and be persuasive. We can't just say this is the way it's always been done in America. We can't even just say the Bible says, therefore, for people who don't believe the Bible or trust the Bible or respect the Bible, we have to go in and, using biblical truths, become, as Wilberforce was over abolition, persuasive till we win hearts and minds, and then by God's grace we're able to affect the culture as salt and light. Now, that notion of civility is often misunderstood, and let me mention the two strongest misunderstandings. One is that we're talking about a lowest common denominator interfaith dialogue. No. Interfaith dialogue almost never goes anywhere. Why? At the end of the day, there are deep and important differences between faiths. There is no lowest common denominator unity. If we all love each other long enough and talk nicely long enough, we'll all get down and hug in the middle and we'll say the same things. We never will. The Christian, the Jew, the atheist, the Mormon, the Muslim, the Scientologist, the Hindu, the Buddhist, or whatever, have very deep and important differences. We're not talking about interfaith dialogue. We're talking about a framework within which we can negotiate our differences without blowing each other out of the water. We can handle our differences with civility, but recognizing the respect for deep differences that actually make a deep difference. We're not talking about some sloppy, ecumenical, lowest common denominator unity. The second misunderstanding, and this is very common, interestingly, in both fundamentalist circles and atheist circles, is that civility is a form of false tolerance. If you respect people's freedom of conscience, you've got to respect what they believe and go along with what they believe and bow to what they believe, accept the whole lot. And surely this is a sloppy tolerance. No. Interestingly, fundamentalists fear that. So also does Richard Dawkins. If you've read Richard Dawkins, The New Atheist, they're extremely intolerant because they're afraid of a false tolerance of things they don't like. I put the civil way like this. The right to believe anything does not mean that anything anyone believes is right. Work that one out over lunch. The right to believe anything does not mean that anything anyone believes is right. The right to believe anything, that's freedom of conscience. Freedom of conscience in terms of belief before the Constitution is absolute. Now you think of that theologically. Our Lord even allows us to choose hell if we will not bow to Him. He does not, in Roger Williams' words, rape our conscience. God respects freedom of conscience, and the price of that is tragic. The right to believe anything is absolute. But of course that doesn't mean that anything anyone believes is right. It means that while we differ with them, we do so civilly. In other words, we persuade them why it's wrong. And you can see in the Old Testament, the prophets and others have their way of arguing against the people of God when the people choose wrongly. And so on. And so we know you need to know as Christians how to debate and get in and persuade and argue prophetically with people who differ with us. But civility does not mean false tolerance. What will it take to achieve it in this country? it'll take first leadership. Probably the depth of the culture warring in America is so bitter and deep today. It will take someone of a Lincoln-like stature and maybe at a Lincoln-like cost to stand against it. Would that we had Christian leaders who stand against it. At the moment, many of our Christian leaders are part of the problem, not part of the answer. It will take leadership. Secondly, it will take vision, far more than I've said in a few words, but a vision articulated by leaders powerfully enough to grab the moral imagination and shift the argument in America, and certainly shift the argument in the religious right beyond the ugliness of where we are today. But thirdly, it will take education. You can't just have ringing moral declarations. You can't just have laws like the Bill of Rights. As the framers understood well, these things are a matter of what Tocqueville called the habits of the heart. In other words, it's when they're a matter of faith and character and virtue, and 5-year-olds and 10-year-olds and 50-year-olds and 80-year-olds all do these things instinctively because they're a habit of the heart. And that takes generation from generation, teaching them, parents to kids, teachers to pupils, and so on. When it's like that, then these things work again. But I would just challenge you, I'm not American. I'm a great admirer of this country, privileged to live here at the moment. America's at a very key moment that goes way beyond all that's been said about the recent election. At a very key moment spiritually, and so is the Church of Christ. And we need, among many things, followers of Jesus who will live out in the public square everything Jesus called us to. We're to be peacemakers. We're to do good when wrong is done to us. We are to forgive without limit. And we are to love our enemies. Yours is a remarkable church. May you also be leaders in standing for a robust, tough-minded, Christianly based civility in public life and around the world. God be with you.